squeezed together in the bay window and saw Sabiha running toward the house, her cloak and dress billowing around her.
"Stop! Don't run! You'll fall over!"
shouted her mother, as if Sabiha could hear her. Kalfa, the manservant, had already opened the door before Selva got downstairs. Sabiha looked radiant. Her eyes sparkled and her face was glowing. Luman Hanum called over the banister.
"How did it go? Was it fun? Were there interesting people?"
"What mother means is, were there any eligible young men?"
Luman Hanum was angered by Selva's remark.
"That's enough, Selva. You've had your say and now it's becoming boring."
Selva realized she had overstepped the mark.
"Sorry, mother."
Sabiha gave her cloak to Kalfa and rushed straight upstairs to her room. She threw herself on her bed, clasped her hands under her chin, and gazed starry-eyed into the distance. Her mother followed her into the room.
"My God, you'll ruin your pretty dress. You shouldn't be lying around in that lovely silk dress. Come on, don't keep us in suspense. Who was there? How was it?"
"Oh, mother, it was wonderful. There was someone called Majid. Apparently, he is Nejmia Hanum's nephew. He was educated in Paris and has joined our Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was great. I mean, very handsome."
"And?"
"Well, it is difficult to say. He danced with Nejla, but he spent most of the time talking to me. He seemed very interested in me."
Selva interrupted.
"Didn't I tell you that you'd be the prettiest one there?"
"The other girls were very pretty, too, but he spent most of his time with me."
"What about the others? Who else was there?"
"Let me see. There was Nejla's brother, Burhan, for instance."
"What about him? What does he do?"
"Who?"
"This Burhan."
"Oh, I really don't know. He did tell me, but I can't remember."
"I see. It seems you are keen on this Majid Bey. I'd better find out more about him before it goes any further."
"There's nothing to find out. I told you, mother."
"You'd better take off that dress before you ruin it completely. Your father should be home shortly,"
Luman Hanum said as she left the room. Selva watched Sabiha undress. She couldn't help admiring her sister as she removed her clothes, examining herself in the mirror.
"Have you actually fallen in love, Sabiha?"
"I don't think so. Can one fall in love in one day? But he really was very attractive."
"I have asked Mother if I can invite some school friends over next week. Why don't we ask him too?"
"With all those girls? You must be joking. He'd be bored to death."
She wasn't keen for Majid to meet Selva. After all, she was taller, if not more beautiful, than Sabiha.
"I'll invite Rafo as well."
"You mean the Jewish guy?"
"Yes, the Jewish guy," said Selva,
imitating her sister.
"Don't get uppity. Am I lying? He is Jewish, isn't he?"
"Yes, he is, but he is different from the others. He's much more intelligent. He's got good manners, and he is very mature."
"Don't bother going on. Save your breath. Whatever he may be, it is an impossible situation."
"Impossible? Can one only be friends with an eye to marriage? Is that it?"
"Life is too short, Selva. How often has Father told us about the value of time? Time is not to be wasted."
"If life is too short, isn't that more reason to make the most of what we've got? To live the way we want to?"
"Does that mean Rafo is what you want?"
Selva didn't reply.
"Rafo,"
Sabiha continued.
"He's certainly a gentleman, I won't deny that. On the other hand, if you're to remain just friends, why not?"
"If he is a gentleman, why shouldn't one marry him?"
"Don't be silly. You know that's impossible."
"Why? Didn't we form the Turkish Republic to do away with such ridiculous prejudices?"
"Now stop right there, Selva. Did you or I form the Republic?
Stop giving me all that V business. Furthermore, those who did form it didn't have the marriage of Turkish girls to non-Muslims in mind, that's for sure. Anyway, this is a typical Selva argument. I don't know why you continue with these loony ideas. You're being childish again, and that's that.
Selva decided not to continue the argument, and Sabia's mind went off on a tangent. If her sister was occupied with this Rafo, it would prevent any rivalry between them over Majid. Why was it that men always paid so much attention to girls like Selva, who didn't make themselves attractive or dress well or even flirt? As far as Sabia was concerned, Selva's only redeeming features were her long hair and swan-like neck. She was polite and sincere, and those qualities appealed to some guys. Still waters run deep, she thought. Sabia felt a pang of jealousy. It was her paternal grandmother who had first planted the seeds of jealousy in her heart. She always made such a thing about being tall. Sabia still remembered how her grandmother would check their height against the bedroom door almost daily, and what a fuss she made when Selva, 2 years younger than Sabiha, had reached the same height. She believed that she and Sabiha, with their opalescent green eyes, were cut from the same cloth, and longed for her granddaughter to be tall and slender. As she marked off her height with a pencil, she would scold Sabiha.
You're not drinking enough milk! Look at Selva! She's getting taller and taller! You'll stay a midget if you're not careful!
Sabia even heard her grandmother telling Luman Hanum off when her mother tried to erase the pencil marks on the bedroom door with soap and water. She overheard her mother saying,
Please don't do this. You're subjecting poor Sabia to unnecessary pressure.
I am doing it deliberately in order to encourage her to have more dairy products.
Dearest mother, it isn't quite as simple as that. Jeans are jeans. Selva has taken after my grandfather. Sabia hasn't. It's as simple as that, and very little can be done about it.
Oh, God! Dear God! How can you say that? Do you want your daughter to remain a midget?
She isn't a midget at all. She is quite normal for her age. It's the other one who is like a beanpole.
Height is a wonderful thing. It suits both men and women. I just love it.
I don't think it suits women. Women should be tiny. After all, don't they say good things come in small packages?
Sabiha was too young to appreciate the wisdom of the proverb and returned to her bedroom. She was her father's beautiful daughter, and Selva was his intelligent one. No matter how Fazıl Reşat Bey tried to cover up his weakness for his younger daughter, he couldn't hide it. His admiration was obvious to anyone who saw the affectionate look in his eyes. He wasn't impressed by Sabiha's beautiful green eyes, framed by very long eyelashes that were just like her mother's. Sabiha knew only too well that her father was far more impressed by brains than beauty. She was used to that. But now this height business, too. Small package indeed. She was what she was, a small package. She had the more beautiful face, but that didn't count. She was still a shorty compared to her sister, a full handbreadth shorter, a small package. Sabiha buried her face in her pillow and cried. Selva sat innocently admiring her sister, not knowing of Sabiha's guilty feelings because she was scheming to avoid potential rivalry.
Rafo is indeed a gentleman, Sabiha said, and what's more, he's very handsome. I don't suppose it would do any harm to flirt a little.
Do you really mean that?
Yes, why not? Why don't you invite him to the end of term ball?
You must be joking. They would never allow it.
I could come with you.
Selva threw herself into her sister's arms and nearly drowned her with kisses.
I didn't realize how much you thought of Rafo. Why didn't you say something before? Well, I have now, so there.
Selva looked at her sister with her big brown eyes. Why this sudden change of heart, she thought. Sabiha was thinking, too. How would Majid react to her younger sister dating a Jew? Would he mind? Somehow, she didn't think so. After all, a young man educated in France must have more worldly ideas. Why should he care if her sister was flirting with a guy who had a different religion? Better she was flirting with him than no one at all. But then, if that was the case, maybe Majid would be interested in Selva, being taller and doe-eyed, and with bold ideas.
Come on, then. Let's invite them both to tea. You can concentrate on Rafo, and I'll look after Majid.
Selva clapped her hands with joy. A week later, they were all enjoying a lovely tea party. Selva's classmates rehearsed their play and then wound up the gramophone to dance the foxtrot to their 78s. The following day, Liman Hanum couldn't help asking her eldest daughter about Rafo.
Did you see how Selva kept looking at that Jewish boy? She was almost devouring him every time he spoke.
He's a polite young man.
As far as I am concerned, he is more of a gentleman than those Turkish guys who are so full of themselves.
The Alfandaris are an old, established family. They come from a line of palace doctors. They have savoir-faire, but all the same, our girl is... Well, you know what she is like. She is unpredictable and stubborn. She has a mind of her own.
Yes, mother, but Raphael wouldn't dare take things further with Selva.
Please don't worry. Besides, don't forget that I am around, and if I notice anything untoward, I'll tell you.
Sabia's promise relaxed Liman Hanum a little. After that first tea party, the same group went to several concerts and picnics together, and each time, Liman Hanum sent Kalfa along as a guardian. Sabiha and Majid became engaged to marry soon, but, according to tradition, Liman Hanum insisted that Selva accompany the couple whenever they went out together. Sabiha turned this to her advantage. The three of them left the house together and went off to a prearranged point, where Rafo would be waiting. From there, the two couples went their separate ways until it was time to return home. By the time Sabiha realized how wrong this was, it was too late. 18 months later, Sabiha and Majid were married. After a splendid wedding, they moved to Ankara so Majid could take up his position in the foreign ministry. Selva started university, studying literature, while Rafo decided to follow in his family's footsteps and study chemistry. Rafo often picked up Selva from her classes or, if he had time, even attended her lectures, just so he could be near her. Some of the other students took exception to this and sometimes picked fights with him because he was daring to court a Muslim girl. One of them remonstrated with Selva.
Can't you find someone of your own religion in the whole of Istanbul?
Another student from the East said,
If you were back home, we'd shoot you for this.
Are you really proud of those primitive thoughts? Asked Selva. How does shooting a person reconcile with being a Muslim, I wonder?
The situation escalated with continual abuse and harassment toward them, until finally, 2 years into his studies, Rafo had to leave the university. Selva was distraught. Rafo had to leave because of her. She began to skip lectures, and by the end of the year had left the university altogether, too. She found it very difficult to explain all this to her father. Gossip about the love between the son of the Alfandaris and the younger daughter of Fazul Reshat Pasha gradually spread to the family. When it got back to Liman Hanum's ears, she took action to try to keep it from her husband. Rafo was banned from visiting the house, and Selva wasn't allowed to go out alone. She spent her time playing the piano, reading books, and corresponding with her sister in Ankara. The only people she saw were either close family friends or relatives. Fazıl Reşat Paşa wasn't very happy with his wife's strict attitude toward Selva. He thought that Luman Hanım was devoting too much energy trying to control Selva now that Sabiha was living away from home. He suggested that Selva should be sent to stay with Sabiha on the pretext of helping her with the new baby. Luman Hanım liked the idea and hoped that her younger daughter might meet a suitable young man. Having received many letters from her mother on this subject, Sabiha set about introducing Selva to as many of their friends as possible. She organized parties at home and took Selva along whenever they were invited out. Through Macit, she introduced Selva to every eligible bachelor in the Foreign Office. Many of the young men took a shine to Selva, but none really interested her. She left them all in Ankara and returned home. Then Luman Hanım insisted that Selva should spend some time with her uncle in Cyprus. The poor woman hoped that if her daughter went away, the flame inside her would burn out, and that would put an end to the gossip. All of these frantic efforts came to nothing. Selva kept the flame alive through her correspondence with Rafo wherever she was. It was inevitable that Fazıl Reşat Paşa would hear about it, and when he did, he was furious. The Pasha confronted his daughter.
"Is what I hear true? Please tell me that these are false accusations spread by nasty-minded people. Tell me that it's malicious gossip," he said.
"I wish I could, father, but I love Rafael Alfandari with all my heart, and if you should grant us permission, I will marry him."
"Never, over my dead body. Do you really expect me to permit such a thing? Doing that would destroy all of our family values and make a mockery of us all. Is this how you repay me for taking such care of you and sending you to foreign schools?"
"I had thought that my education was meant to expand my horizons, that you wanted me to be an equal, father."
"I had you and your sister well educated, hoping that one day you would present me with grandchildren, not so you'd rebel against me."
"Rebelling against you is the last thing on my mind, father. All I ask is that I choose my own life's partner. I am not asking you to accept an immoral, worthless person as a son-in-law. The only thing you can object to is that he is not a Muslim. Haven't you told us on countless occasions that people should be free to worship exactly how they wish and that every belief was holy?"
The gravity of the situation brought about a rage that could not be associated with the sort of gentleman Fazıl Reşat Paşa was. He managed to control his actions around his daughter, but the moment he dismissed her, he set about breaking every single crystal vase and mirror in the room. Sabiha was asked to come from Ankara at once to try to help calm her father down and to persuade Selva to give up her obsession. Both she and Luman Hanım spent days on end trying to bring Selva to her senses. Luman Hanım was beside herself. She couldn't sleep at night and spent hours walking from room to room, tearing at her hair.
"How on earth did we come to this? Why the hell did I allow that snake to slither into my house? Why didn't I see this coming?"
Seeing her mother's despair made Sabiha feel very guilty. But she didn't have the strength to tell her mother the truth. If she had only been able to say,
"It's not your fault, mother. It was me. I used Rafo to get Selva out of my way."
Just these few words would clear her conscience a little. She had even wished that she were a Catholic. If she were, it would simply be a matter of confession, accepting whatever penance was meted out by the priest. At least she would have been able to rid herself of this burden. Realizing that Selva was a lost cause, Sabiha turned her attention to her father. He felt that Sabiha had made a good choice and found an ideal husband, but she couldn't even rejoice in that, knowing how she had gone about it. Fazıl Reşat Paşa felt completely betrayed. He had brought up his daughters to be part of the modern world, exactly the same as if they'd been sons, as was expected by the new republic. They had had good educations, spoke several languages, and were fit to play active roles in society. But he was beginning to have second thoughts now. What exactly had he achieved, having such great ambitions for them? Hadn't his eldest daughter married before she was 19, just like in the old days? As for the younger one, that wise, clever, quiet girl with personality to spare, hadn't she betrayed him in the cruelest way? This all seemed to be a terrible nightmare. What made it even worse was that Selva had used all the advice he had ever given her against him. Fazıl Reşat Paşa realized he had been wrong. The only honorable thing an officer and gentleman could do was to pay with his own life. He felt sure that if Selva saw him dead, she would realize how foolish she had been. Maybe she would change her mind if she saw that his only peace lay in his grave. Selva wrote a note to her father saying that, as the family didn't approve, she would not marry Rafo, but that she would not give him up. Fazıl Reşat Paşa went ahead with his suicide attempt, but it was foiled by Kalfa, who wrestled the gun from him, causing him to shoot himself in the shoulder. This emotional blackmail annoyed Selva more than it frightened her. "It has become impossible to live in this city," she told her sister. "We are going to live in France. His family is against our marriage, too. We have no alternative under these circumstances." Leman Hanım swallowed her pride and sent word to Rafo, asking him to reconsider this move. The only real problem was his religion. Maybe he could convert to Islam. If he were to do that, then maybe they could persuade Fazıl Reşat Paşa to accept him into the family. Selva didn't give Rafo a chance to respond to this preposterous suggestion, telling her sister, "I'd rather give him up than ask him to change his religion for me. What sort of people are you? Can you imagine if the boot were on the other foot? How would you all feel if he asked me to change my religion to please his family?" Macit was then asked to try to intervene. Maybe the young rebel would listen to her brother-in-law, because she loved him very much. "Macit, I am sure you know about the Jewish way of life. They believe that the children should follow the mother's religion. Can you imagine what it would mean to them to have a daughter-in-law of a different religion? Oh, Macit, why is there all this fuss? Something that should bring joy has turned our lives into a nightmare."
"Listen, Selva, we can talk about religion till the cows come home, but let's first of all try to solve this problem. To begin with, why are you being so stubborn about asking Rafo to convert to Islam?"
"It's a matter of principle, Macit. We fell in love knowing exactly where we came from. Everyone has a right to their own beliefs. Had he asked me to convert, I would have been hurt and angry myself. No, Rafo will never change his religion. Please give my apologies to my father."
"You should apologize yourself.
Give it another try. Speak to him. He refuses to see me."
In despair, Leman Hanım, caught between a stubborn husband and an equally stubborn daughter, broke down and sobbed.
"Let her marry the Jew! God forbid we should have to bear the shame of our daughter living as someone's mistress!"
Selva and Rafa were married that September at the Beyoğlu Registry Office in Istanbul, in the presence of two witnesses and a handful of friends. After the ceremony, the small group dined at the Pera Palace Hotel, where the young couple spent the night before leaving for Paris by train the next morning. None of Rafo's family was at the station, but Leman Hanım and Sabiha were there on the platform to say goodbye. Leman Hanım chose to ignore Rafo, but waved to Selva as the train pulled away. Selva returned their waves. Her outward calm covered her inner turmoil. The three women continued waving to each other until the train was out of sight. On the way home, Sabiha felt a sudden sharp pain, as if she were being stabbed by a knife. The sister she had been jealous of for all those years had disappeared in the black smoke of the train. No more rivalry, no more sharing their parents' affections, no more sharing her husband's admiration. They were all hers, now that Selva would be hundreds of miles away. Strangely, instead of feeling relieved, Sabiha felt inconsolably sad. About a month later, Sabiha was again called back to Istanbul. Luman Hanum had had an acute attack of asthma, as well as uncontrollably high blood pressure. Both parents had been continuously ill, one after the other, since Selva's departure. They seemed to be falling apart at the seams. If it wasn't blood pressure, it was chest pains. If it wasn't chest pains, it was rheumatism, one thing after another. Each time there was a problem, Sabiha came from Ankara on the night train and remained until her parents had recovered. When she returned to Ankara, Sabiha took off her nurse's hat and put on that of a diplomat's wife, carrying out her duties. The cocktail parties, dinners, and receptions she once enjoyed dressing up for now became a chore. She continued to attend them, but she no longer enjoyed being part of the crowd. She was permanently miserable, guilty at having been the culprit. Yes, she was the devil that had imposed all the pain and turmoil on her family for her own ends. Time and again, she tried to discuss the matter with Majid, but he would only say that she wasn't to blame. Her bull-headed sister would never change her mind, whatever they said. It was obvious that he was bored of the subject. What had happened, had happened. What was the use of opening up old wounds? Ankara. Sabiha had made a few friends in Ankara, especially among the mothers at her daughter's school. They were also the wives of her husband's colleagues, most of whom had been raised in Istanbul too. These ladies would often get together to play bezik, or bridge. In fact, Sabiha had her own bridge group. But since Selva had married and left for Paris, more often than not she preferred to stay at home and read a book or play the piano. She was almost scared that if she went along, the inevitable gossip session would turn to Selva, and she didn't want to face their questions. Luman Hanum, despite her various ailments, was better at dealing with the gossip mongers. Whenever the subject was raised in her presence, she would simply say,
"Our daughter went ahead with her own life, although we obviously didn't approve. We may be apart, but we certainly include her in our prayers. There is nothing more to say on the subject."
Sabiha would react to this by thinking,
"That's okay for you, mother. You have no reason to have a guilty conscience."
Sabiha's best and most trusted friend in Ankara was one of Majid's young clerks, Tarık Arıca. Tarık was born in Malatya in eastern Anatolia. He went to primary school there, then secondary school and then the lycée in Sivas, all of which gave him a good grounding for the Istanbul School of Political Sciences, where his excellent results enabled him to join the ministry. He was very bright, eager to learn, and gained rapid promotions. The only problem was his lack of languages, but he was determined to put this right. He took weekend classes in French and studied very hard. Having heard from Majid that Sabiha spoke very good French, he asked if she could help him, and she gladly agreed. If he hadn't any commitments in the evening, he would visit the house and sit and talk to Sabiha in French until dinner time. Selva would send French magazines to her sister, and she in turn would pass them on to Tarık and help him solve the French crosswords. Sabiha grew to love this bright, calm, honest young man. He hadn't an ounce of prejudice or malice in him. In a way, Sabiha felt that Tarık and Selva were very similar in character. One day she plucked up enough courage to tell Tarık about Selva's scandal. What a relief to be able to tell someone. What a weight off her mind. Maybe her depression was caused from trying to hide the truth. If only Majid wouldn't stop her talking about it. Majid had behaved this way in order to stop his wife from getting upset. What he hadn't realized was that she needed to open the floodgates. She needed to cry, stamp, and kick to release all her pent-up tension. Now that she had such a good, trusted listener as Tarık, she was relieved. He had read between the lines and he understood the problem entirely. He hadn't asked painful questions. He had just listened. Tarık never spoke to Majid on this subject. This was between Sabiha and Tarık alone. An overseas posting. Majid entered the ground floor meeting room at the foreign ministry to find his colleagues chatting around the table. The foreign minister soon joined them and the meeting began officially. For some time now, Britain had been urging Turkey to declare war on Italy and form a front line with Yugoslavia and Greece. President İnönü had continually dragged his feet to avoid getting involved in this conflict. Now Britain had sent another communique. The British requested that Turkey declare publicly that, if the Germans invaded Bulgaria, Turkey would consider that as an attack on herself. Furthermore, Britain asked Turkey to send troops to some of the Greek islands in order to stop the Germans from attacking them. After reading the note, those around the table began offering their opinions.
"Our president doesn't agree with any of it," said the foreign minister. "And I totally agree with him. Taking such actions, albeit with good intentions, may be interpreted wrongly."
"But, sir, we wouldn't be sending our troops to invade the islands. We'd be providing protection from the Germans,"
one of the delegates said.
"I know the president doesn't want to have the slightest confrontation with the Greeks," interrupted the minister. "We may have the best of intentions, but the Greeks may misunderstand this. We shouldn't risk any possibility of conflict with our neighbors in these heated times. When Hitler attacked the Balkans, Turkey and Greece began the most amicable relationship in their history. This relationship shouldn't be jeopardized under any circumstances."
"There is another thing we should consider," said Majid. "If we send troops to Greece, Hitler will attack us immediately. How are we to defend ourselves then? The Allies haven't even provided us with the arms they promised."
"And I have doubts they ever will," said the foreign minister.
Britain had signed an agreement with Greece pledging to defend her if she was attacked. But when the Italians did attack, all the British did was send two aircraft squadrons.
"We signed an agreement with them in Paris, but as Majid Bey has just pointed out, so far nothing has come of it," said the Prime Minister. "They haven't been able to deliver any of the promised arms. That, despite the fact that you pointed out the importance of having a well-equipped army in Turkey to dissuade attacks on the Balkans, sir," said Majid, turning to the foreign minister.
"They didn't keep to the agreement. Not because they didn't want to, but because they couldn't,"
the foreign minister said.
"Maybe this is a blessing in disguise. Since they haven't delivered the goods, we don't have to abide by our side of the agreement either."
Majid didn't find it necessary to hide his joy at this. Neither, it appeared, did the rest of the gathered assembly.
"What is it that they say? Every cloud has a silver lining."
İnönü now had the perfect excuse for not joining the war. It was as though luck were on his side. If the Italians invaded Greece, then they would be on Turkey's doorstep. Since Turkey didn't have the arms to defend herself, what would be the good of siding with Britain? After hours of discussion, the minister was able to draft a response to the British. Majid took the draft. He opened the door for the minister to leave.
"I will bring it to you as soon as it is ready," he said respectfully.
"I'll be in my office,"
the minister said to the general secretary.
"We must remember that there are other important matters to deal with too, including the posting to Paris.
You know they are desperate for more staff there. We mustn't let them down.
Majid got home in the early hours of the morning. He undressed in the sitting room and lay down on the sofa so as not to disturb Sabiha. He was absolutely exhausted and fell into a deep sleep, not even missing his bed. He was dead tired, but nightmares kept invading his mind. It was as though those long meetings were coming back to haunt him. He dreamed that the Germans had attacked Ankara and were dragging his wife and child toward a train bound for a labor camp. He ran desperately to the train, trying to get on it himself, to be with them. The next morning at the office, Majid saw Taruk. They were both still really tired.
"Have you got any plans for the weekend?" Majid asked.
"I have my French lesson between 9 and 12 on Sunday, as you know, but nothing else after that."
"Don't make any plans. I'll ask Khalid to join us if he is free, and we can all have lunch together at Chieftlik open-air restaurant, if the weather is fine. Then we can play bridge at home. How does that sound?"
"Sounds good to me," said Taruk. "How is Sabiha Hanum?"
"Fine, fine. Well, neither good nor bad, really. I've never been able to understand what makes women tick." "Well, enough of that," he said. "Don't forget Sunday. I am sure Sabiha will be thrilled if you join us."
Majid was on his way to another of his long meetings. He collected the files from his office, tucked them under his arm, and rushed out. The telephone rang, and Taruk picked it up.
"Hello? Yes, sir. Yes.
Yes.
Of course I can. I'll be there right away, sir."
Buttoning his jacket, Taruk told the secretary that the secretary general wanted to see him, adding,
"If anybody rings, tell them, 'Hell, never mind. I'll be back shortly.'"
"I hope it's nothing serious,"
she said as Taruk left the room. Why would the chief want to see Taruk and not Majid Bey, she wondered. Taruk returned to his office half an hour later with the same look of surprise he'd had when he left. When Majid returned about an hour later, he found Taruk emptying his desk, piling everything on top.
"When you have finished tidying up, maybe we can grab some lunch," Majid said. "There are some interesting developments we need to discuss."
Taruk hurriedly replaced the files in the drawer.
"I've got things to tell you too," he said. "Really?"
"I'd like to thank you for the kind reference you wrote for my file."
"What's this all about?"
"I heard about your reference today."
"Those are supposed to be strictly confidential."
"Yes, of course. I only got the gist of it, but I know that you wrote some very positive things."
"Who told you so?"
"The Secretary General."
"Unbelievable."
"Majid Bey, I'll tell you all about it over lunch. However, I'd like to tell you right away that you will have to find someone to replace me for bridge on Sunday."
"What on earth are you talking about, Taruk?"
"I won't be in Ankara on Sunday."
"I do hope that it is nothing serious. Inshallah, there is no death or sickness in the family."
"No, no, thank God."
"Sabiha will be most disappointed."
Walking downstairs, the two colleagues continued their conversation.
"When Sabiha Hanum finds out where I'll be, she will be very happy for me."
Majid stopped suddenly and looked directly into Taruk's face.
"Are you telling me that you are getting married by any chance?"
"I'm talking about an overseas position, Majid Bey. I've just been appointed second secretary in Paris."
"Oh, that.
You knew then?"
"I knew it was under discussion. There was no question that you could cope with the job. But there was the language problem. This foreign minister asked me about your progress with French. I told him about your weekend lessons and the conversation practice with Sabiha."
"Yes, he told me that too. He told me everything was fine and that I could improve my French when I got there."
"I agree. You're one of the ministry's brightest young men, my friend. I am very happy for you, but the occupied area is dangerous."
"Yes, of course. That's why they prefer someone who is single."
Majid put his hand on Taruk's shoulder.
"Congratulations," he said. I'm sure you'll be very successful. Sabiha will be pleased and sorry, too. You know how she values your friendship. When are you off?
Apparently I'm to leave immediately. I had intended to visit my family in Malatya over the holiday, but it isn't to be. I wonder when I'll see them again. Needless to say, I must come and say goodbye to Sabiha Hanum. There may be a few things she would like me to take to her sister.
Majid tried to conceal his surprise that Sabiha had told Taruk a secret she'd kept from everyone else in Ankara. Come on, I am taking you to my favorite restaurant, Karpic, for a farewell lunch.
Thank you, Majid, said Taruk.
The look of surprise on his face was beginning to turn to anxiety about the future, with a hint of pride. Sabiha indeed had mixed feelings about Taruk's posting. On the one hand, she was losing her close, trusted friend. On the other, she hoped that Taruk being in Paris would be advantageous for Selva. Should there be the need, Selva and her child could at least seek refuge in the embassy. Taruk would also be able to help Rafo too, if necessary. When they spoke about this during their goodbyes, Majid was quick to point out that Taruk was going to Paris, and Selva and her family were in Marseille.
Don't worry about that, Taruk said. I am sure I will be able to communicate with them. I'll telephone them as soon as I arrive in Paris.
When Sabiha went into the kitchen to fetch the tea, Majid turned to Taruk with a word of warning.
Be careful, Taruk. This is very sensitive. Don't get yourself into any trouble. You are a Turkish diplomat and your duties come first. You shouldn't jeopardize your own position because of Selva and Rafo.
Sabiha was in tears when Taruk left.
I'll miss you, Taruk. I'm losing a very dear friend, she said, her voice trembling. You're not losing me at all. Inshallah, we'll see each other again after my posting is over. If I can manage to speak French at all, it is thanks to you, Sabiha Hanum.
He gently kissed Sabiha's hand, just as Majid and Newman Bey did on such occasions, stopping himself from touching his forehead with his hand as they did back home. How could anyone know that this was the first time he had kissed a lady's hand without touching it to his forehead? What he really wanted was to press Sabiha's hand tightly in his. He wished he could put his arms around her slender figure and breathe in the scent of her long blonde hair. The woman of his dreams, the woman he would one day marry, must resemble Sabiha. Walking down the long hallway on his way out, what he'd never wanted to admit before suddenly dawned on him. Wherever he went, he'd never forget Sabiha's fair complexion or her sad green eyes. She would always have a special place in his heart. After Taruk left, Sabiha went straight to her room and lay motionless on her bed with her eyes closed. Majid entered the room.
There is something I want to propose to you, he said.
About the fourth for bridge tomorrow?
No, darling. It's just that I have been thinking. You spend a lot of time on your own.
Sabiha opened her eyes, looking at her husband as he continued.
It looks like we are going to be extremely busy at the office over the next few days. I won't have any spare time to spend with you. We seem to be facing a new crisis every day. I was wondering.
What were you wondering?
Why don't we invite your parents here? Now that Istanbul is being evacuated, they could stay with us for a while. It would be a change for them and you won't have to worry.
Sabiha sat up on her bed.
That's an excellent idea.
Yes, I think so, Majid said, continuing with a certain reproach in his voice. Since you no longer have anyone to share your secret with.
What? What do you mean by that?
I find it very interesting that you tell no one here about Selva, and yet Taruk seems to be fully aware of it.
Majid, he listened to me.
Did you try to tell anyone else who would listen, Sabiha?
To whom would I turn?
How do I know? Birsen, Nejla, Humeira? You see them at least once a week. Don't you have any other friends? Why are you so obsessed with talking about Selva? Honestly, I don't understand why you continue to torture yourself about her.
You'll never understand.
Sabiha replied reproachfully, feeling a little proud. After all, wasn't there the hint of jealousy in Majid's remark? From Istanbul to Paris. Tarek put the letter he had written to his mother, together with a few banknotes, in an envelope and sealed it carefully. He was sad that he wouldn't be able to visit his family for the holiday, and the thought of not knowing when he would see them again really depressed him. What bothered him most was that his father hadn't lived long enough to see his promotion. He would have dearly loved to visit his grave, say a prayer, and thank him.
Dear father, your sacrifices haven't been in vain. May you rest in peace, safe in the knowledge that I'll conduct my life in the honorable way that you would want me to.
Luckily, his apartment mates in Ankara returned the deposit he had paid for his room, and it was this money that he was able to send to his mother. He hoped he would be able to save money in Paris so he could continue to support her. He had not been able to go to his family, nor had he had time to have a haircut before leaving. As soon as he was notified about his posting, he managed to duck out of the office, buy a suitcase, and book his ticket to Istanbul on the overnight train. His friends had advised him to do his shopping in Istanbul, and Majid gave him the names of several stores, insisting that he at least buy himself a good coat. Tarık meticulously packed his gray suit and three white shirts. Between the shirts, he placed the letter and the small gift Sabiha had given him. He hoped that she hadn't put any money in her letter, but he hadn't the heart to open it and check. Yet friends who had been abroad had warned him that the Germans regularly rummage through suitcases. Tarık got everything ready for the overnight train to Istanbul next evening. He hung his new, freshly pressed dark blue suit in the wardrobe. He placed his passport, wallet, and train ticket on his bureau, beside the pocket watch he kept as a reminder of his father. From the frame of the mirror, he removed a photograph and looked at it for a moment. It was a picture taken of a group at the races. The half-dozen or so faces were tiny. Yet Sabiha, with her long blonde hair, stood out distinctly. He put the photograph in his wallet. He was about to embark on an adventure he could never have dreamed of back in the Lycée in Sivas, and a cold shiver went down his spine. He switched off the bare overhead light and turned on his bedside lamp, holding his French book in his hand.
"Moi, je m'appelle Tarık Arıca,"
he said to himself.
"My name is Tarık Arıca. Je viens d'Ankara. Je suis le consul général de Turquie. I come from Ankara. I am the consul general of Turkey." My God, surely not.
No, that wasn't right at all. He would merely be the second secretary. There was a long way to go before he became the consul, or even the deputy consul.
"Mr. Consul," he murmured, closing his eyes tightly. "Or how about Mr. Ambassador?" "Yes, Mr. Ambassador, His Excellency, Tarık Bey."
He tried to picture himself in a top hat and tails, with a white scarf around his neck holding a silver-topped cane. But the only vision that came to mind was that of a blonde woman. She was bent over a desk covered with books, sweeping back her blonde hair with her long fingers as it fell across her face. He only imagined it, but her green eyes were so clear. Perhaps her daughter was called Hulya, meaning illusion, after her mother's dreamy eyes. Still in his dream, the same slender woman approached him and spoke to him in French, asking a question and then looking directly into his eyes. Tarık's hands began to sweat.
What would this beautiful woman think of him if he was to answer in his funny accent? Such a vision. Such a beauty. He tried to clear his throat before speaking.
Oui, je voudrais beaucoup, avoir, yes, I would very much like to have...
Please don't be nervous, Taruk, said the vision. Keep calm. Think of what you want to say first.
My accent is dreadful. I feel embarrassed.
Nonsense. You shouldn't worry about your accent. Everyone speaking a foreign language has an accent. French isn't your mother tongue. Majid has an accent, so do I.
No, not you.
You don't.
Perhaps it's because we had a French nanny when we were young, but rest assured, no foreigner can speak a new language without an accent.
Don't feel embarrassed, Taruk. Repeat what you said, and I will correct you if you make a mistake.
Taruk felt the agony in his dream. He was deliriously happy, yet his palms were sweating and his heart fluttering like a bird's wings. He was scared not only of making a mistake, but also, and more importantly, that he was falling in love. Taruk got out of bed and paced the room. No, this wasn't love. Perhaps it was a kind of idealization, he thought. Did he simply desire what was unattainable? To an Anatolian from the east of Turkey, Sabiha was the ideal woman. Blonde, beautiful, well-educated, and with all the social graces. She could speak several languages and was able to mix with all sorts of people, from all walks of life. He had never met such a woman before. On top of all this, she was his boss's wife. His friend's wife. Wasn't it Majid who had written that excellent report about him, who was so instrumental in his promotion? Should he eventually marry, Tariq knew that Sabiha was everything he wanted in a wife. That's it. This wasn't love. It was admiration. Back in bed, Taruk wanted to fall asleep. But this time his excitement for the day ahead kept him awake. He was returning to Istanbul for the first time since his university days, and he was looking forward to being back in the city of domes and plane trees. He thought of the days when just walking down Pera Street in Beyoğlu was considered an adventure. And now he was returning to that enchanted city as a diplomat. A busy time lay ahead. Majid had recommended shopping at Carlman Arcade, followed by dinner at Rejan's, the Russian restaurant, where he should have the chicken Kiev washed down with yellow vodka to the strains of the Balalaika Orchestra. Another of Majid's musts was a visit to the garden bar at Tepebashi, or to the Park Hotel for a nightcap. Taruk wasn't one for drinking on his own, but he thought that he should make the most of his couple of days in Istanbul. They might be a sampler of the sophisticated times ahead for him. He didn't really care for the company of the boring snobs who frequented the bars and restaurants of Istanbul, but at least they spoke his language. And then what? What would become of him once he boarded that train and mixed with the other passengers? They probably wouldn't be speaking Turkish. He was headed for an occupied country. Europe was in the grip of war, and what if that war spread to Turkey? What if he never returned to his country again? He had only enough money to last him a couple of weeks, and he spoke a little bit of French. What if he got stuck in that turmoil? The few French words he'd uttered a short while ago came back to him. With fear in his voice, he said to himself,
Je suis le deuxième secrétaire à l'ambassade de Turquie.
He repeated this in his head, and then another sentence came to mind.
Please, God help me.
It was almost 5 in the morning before he fell asleep. That year's spring had arrived in Istanbul hand in hand with sorrow. The dark lines of anxiety under everyone's eyes didn't go unnoticed by Taruk. The fear of war burdened everyone, young and old, men and women, rich and poor. No one was spared. By radio and newspaper, the government had issued the instructions for everyone to build bunkers or shelters. If an apartment building was more than 3 floors high, its ground floor had to be converted to a shelter with windows covered by sandbags. As a result, the city looked like one giant construction site. In spite of all this, Beyoğlu was still as buzzing, as colorful and joyful as Taruk remembered. When Taruk left the Haydar Pasha station on the Asian side of Istanbul, he could smell the salty sea air. He took the ferry over to Karaköy on the European side. Even though he was cold, he deliberately sat on the outside deck so he could watch the white frothy waves on the sea. Once at Karaköy, he hailed a taxi and sat next to the driver, giving him the slip of paper with the address of his hotel. The taxi driver drove through Yüksek Kaldırım to Pera and stopped in front of the Londra Hotel. There were sandbags piled in front of it, just as Taruk had seen in front of the other buildings on the short drive.
"Look at all this," the driver said, pointing to the sacks. "It gets on people's nerves. We are not at war, but just look at this mess. We can hardly drive through the streets."
"It is always better to be cautious," said Taruk.
"God forbid there should be a sudden air raid. Where would people find shelter?" "It's fate, sir," said the driver. "Who knows when their number's up?"
The driver's words sent a chill down Taruk's spine, and yet, how typically fatalistic of a Turk. Taruk had thought that abandoning oneself to fate was a trait of people from the East. But here, this Istanbul driver thought along the same lines. He got out of the taxi, and even before paying his fare, he stood gazing at the view spread out before him. The silhouettes of the mosques, the domed cupolas, the plane trees on the hills, and the minarets pointing into the sky. It was indeed a breathtaking view. On the hillside, the red buds of Judas trees were just beginning to bloom. Istanbul looked like a watercolor, bright purple, blue, and green all mixed together with dashes of black India ink. In 3 days, he would be leaving this extraordinary city to go to a war zone. He paid the driver and collected his luggage. He couldn't help imitating the driver's tone of voice as he mumbled to himself, "It's fate, sir. Who knows when their number's up?" Walking up the hotel steps, he came face to face with a commissionaire, dressed like a palace guard. He put down his suitcase as the commissionaire, full of his own importance, summoned the bellboy. Just as the bellboy was putting the suitcase on the trolley, there was a frightful bang and Taruk fell flat on his face. Suddenly, all hell let loose. There was the crashing of broken windows and people shrieking for help all around. Taruk lifted his head and saw the bellboy lying next to him.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
The boy turned his head and looked with a dazed expression. The mucus on his upper lip looked like a greasy mustache.
"Where the hell are we? Are we dead or alive?"
"We're not dead, my boy. We're lying at the entrance to the hotel."
"I don't believe it, sir."
"A bomb exploded nearby," Taruk explained, struggling to stand up. He had hurt his knees very badly and had difficulty straightening up. The whole area was enveloped in a cloud of smoke and dust. Others around them who had been caught up in the explosion were coming out from under stairs or doorways and stretching. A short period of silence, broken by the agonized howling of a dog, ended with the din of Judgment Day. Children started to cry. Men and women called for help. Police and guards blew their whistles and cars sounded their horns. Taruk finally stood up. There was glass in his hair, and his clothes were filthy. The bellboy was still lying face down on the ground. Taruk tried to lift him up.
"Come on, my boy. You'd better try to stand up."
The young boy sat up but was still visibly shaken. When Taruk realized that he couldn't get him up, he knelt down beside him and slapped him across the face. The boy started to cry. By now, people were pouring out through the hotel lobby in panic. Taruk looked around.